This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. James Graschow is an artist, and he's a fan of the work of Baroque sculptor Gianlorenzo Bernini. He's such a fan that he decided to build a giant fountain inspired by him. Graschow's known for building artworks out of material like papier-mâché and chicken wire and fabric. So perhaps it wasn't too surprising when he decided to make his fountain out of corrugated cardboard and twist ties. But here's where the story gets a little weird. When it was all done, Graschow put it outside in the rain and watched it disintegrate. After spending 6 years refining the tiniest details, North Carolina filmmaker and erstwhile State of Things producer Olympia Stone followed the project from start to finish, and she has a documentary out about it called The Cardboard Bernini. Olympia Stone, welcome back to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank. Thanks so much for having me.
And as a former producer, you know that all you had to do is call it The Cardboard Bernini and you would be on the show.
I had a feeling.
Tell us about how you came to know about this project or about the particular artwork that we're talking about.
Well, I have known James Graschow my whole life because my father was his art dealer for many, many years. And I, in fact, grew up with his artwork in my home, and it was actually a source of terror for me growing up. His work, a lot of times people mistake it for cute, but it's really has a very scary edge to it. And there was one piece in particular that I had to walk by every night before I wanted to get a glass of milk in the kitchen. And it was called Murder Mâché. And it was a bunch of huge 15-foot tall papier-mâché men that were strangling each other with their tongues sticking out and eyeballs popping. And I was sure that they were going to come to life every night. So I would say his work really occupied a sort of deep emotional place in my childhood imaginations. And I've loved his work, even though sometimes it was really scary. And this whole thing came to be because my father died in 2006. And one of those pieces, in fact, the Murder Mâché, went outside. My father put it outside of our house, and that was sort of the genesis of the story.
He put it outside, and James Graschow came to pay his respects. Let's listen to part of your film.
Anyway, so Alan died, and I went down for, you know, to make a condolence call to, you know, to the house, and there these figures were, decaying at an unbelievable rate. To see my dealer lump it like a piece of garbage on a, you know, in the backyard was almost a verification of all the negative feelings that I've ever had about myself, my work, my own aspirations to do something great or something eternal. But they were so beautiful, they were so magical in their decay. It was extraordinary. The work was better than anything that I'd ever imagined.
All right, so here it is, this kind of moment of truth for him, right? And yet, early on in the film, he tells us that he works in these perishable materials precisely because he feels like in a way, all of his work and all of our work is ephemeral and perishable. So he had some inkling, right?
This was absolutely, and he talks about this in the film, that this has been a seed that has been present throughout his entire life, really. And as a child, you know, asking the big questions of the universe and then really pursuing a career where he wasn't working in steel. You know, he wasn't working in these materials that are you know, that we think are going to stand the test of time. But this, in a way, was really the moment of truth where he thought, I am going to follow the end of this inevitable process that I haven't really allowed myself to think about before. And I was just so interested in that idea.
Is that when he decided to recreate the Bernini?
Yeah. I mean, I think that was definitely the catalyst. Yeah. There had been other reasons why he was thinking about, he had been invited to work in Italy and do a workshop, and he thought it would be amazing to do a Bernini and leave it in a piazza somewhere and let it, you know, dissolve. But then, you know, it sort of circled back to the idea again.
When and then we should describe the piece, because Bernini is this fabulous Baroque sculptor who's, when you think about the European fountains, these are the pieces that come to mind. So tell us about the particular piece that he decided to recreate.
Well, see, I should say it's inspired by. So he speaks about the Trevi Fountain as sort of a famous. It's a Bernini, largely Bernini-made piece, but it turns out Bernini was not the final, the actual one who built the Trevi Fountain, but many of his original designs for that were intact. And I think Jimmy would say that fountain is the inspiration, and he sees that as very, very much what Bernini was able to do with marble and just a source of inspiration to him as an artist.
He then sets about making this remarkably detailed, and you have to try to describe it for us. And I'm looking at the flyer here that is now, and here's a spoiler alert, because he succeeded, right, in
right.
his goal.
Yeah.
So only these photographs now exist of the project, but it's remarkable. He's working in cardboard in remarkably detailed, monstrous, colossal sculpture that he does.
Yeah, and I love – that's one of the things I love about what he did is he takes this everyday material that you just – you know, how many times do you get an Amazon.com, you know, box in the mail or whatever, and you toss it aside? He's really taken it and turned it into something so magnificent. And people – I saw people's reactions when he – when he had openings and showed this sculpture before it went outside, and people were just, you know, their jaws dropped because it is so detailed, and it really has movement in it that is hard to believe is just a cardboard box.
Yeah, that's the thing that's striking, the power, the strength that these horses convey, the movement, their hair is blowing back, the actual power, you can feel the wind blowing against these horses and the strength of their legs. It's cardboard. Let's listen to James Grashow talk about his medium.
If you pay for great papers or great canvas or fabulous paints, you can't make a mistake. Every inch of what you do is valuable. Cardboard, it's so worthless. It's so grateful to be rescued from trash. It's just like humans. We aspire to be something more, to be holy, to be grand, to be eternal, but we're tied to mortality. Cardboard and people, we're made almost from the same kind of DNA, I think.
He's a mystic, isn't he?
Yeah.
He is.
He's an artist philosopher.
Yeah, yeah. And
really
a guy
is.
Who thinks deeply about the big questions, yeah. And is constantly going back and forth between, you know, vanity, vanity, all his vanities. And then, well, then what do I do about it? I mean,
right.
Seems like that guy. Talk about the detail, because he has details in this, and maybe you can give us the scale and the scope of the actual work, because there are details in this that no one will ever see unless they really kind of walk around behind it and through it, right?
Right. I mean, there is, for example, I watched him spend 2 or 3 days working on just one seashell that he made. So he had to figure out how to get the seashell to curve. And I mean, you can't imagine. He made all these prototypes and, you know, I saw so much of the blood, sweat, and tears that went into this, you know, the incredible amount of physical labor. And Jimmy just turned 71 this past January, and he thinks about that a lot, how, you know, his work requires a lot of stamina to build these huge things. And Poseidon figure that's in the piece is huge. You know, it's 17 feet long. I mean, he's big, and it takes a lot of physical effort, right. You know, to do this. So each of the fins on the fish that he's made are, he's taken a little tiny X-Acto knife and made, you know, a million different, you know, marks in the cardboard to make the lines work out. Or he made, you know, a million sea fish scales, you know, seahorse scales. And it boggles the mind.
Because bear in mind that all the while, every minute from beginning to end, he knows where it's going to end up.
And I thought for me as a filmmaker, that was such an interesting thing, was that he could not do it to the fullest extent. He couldn't cut any corners. And he drove himself crazy with that. You know, why can't I just forget the backside of this piece that nobody's going to see anyway, and it's going to be destroyed? Why do I feel compelled to make it perfect, you know? And yet he did. And he really poured everything that he had into it.
See, because he's just confronting what the rest of us fail or refuse to look at that deeply, which is, it all might be meaningless, but if I got 70 years to spend some time on the planet, how am I going to keep myself busy? I'm reducing his work and his philosophy to mush here. But you also, I mean, now you juxtapose his ideas and the way he thinks about his work with his family. You spend a lot of time with them. And they don't share his philosophy, but they dearly love him. This exchange between him and his wife over the work itself, while it's in progress, I think they're, maybe, what was he, about halfway through?
Yeah.
About now, and this comes midway through the film. Let's listen.
Now he's really embraced this, making this and then having it just implode. It's upsetting. Yeah, it's very upsetting. I get emotional about it. You know, I it's hard for me to embrace, I'm going to cry, you know, working on this so much and, you know.
But that's the tragedy, that seems to me the tragedy of life. It seems to me it seems to embrace exactly what life is. You know, it's so sad.
It's so sad. And she laughs. And there it is. He's
there
got it. There
is.
It is.
Yeah.
Dead center of your film. So now he's finished, and it's taken how many years?
Well, the whole process took 6 years from beginning to end. Yeah. Yeah.
Was there any point along the way that you thought, or that he expressed openly, the possibility that he change his mind?
No, I mean, I never actually really doubted that he was going to go through with it. Although, you know, sometimes I had my moments, but I think that he was so committed to the idea of seeing it through that it was so important for him as an artist to experience this, that I really didn't question that he was actually going to go through with it. But we did have a lot of challenges trying to find a museum that would be on board with having a big pile of cardboard mush in there, you know, prominently displayed. So that, you know, there were some challenges in that sense. And we joked about how, you know, if maybe we would have a bonfire in his backyard if we couldn't figure anything else out. But luckily it did work.
Did he take it around to a few places first before he found a final resting place?
Yeah, he showed it in Roanoke, Virginia at the Taubman Museum and actually at my father's gallery in New York. And those were the two sort of viewings before it went outside. So it had a little life before that happened.
You show the moment when he reveals to the family that he's finished, the finished product. I mean, how did he look? How did he feel about that thing when it was now? He claims that the finish is really when it's a heap, right? I mean, that's what he's saying. But what we would consider the finished product, how did he look?
He was pretty emotional about it. I mean, I think he was so pleased when he saw the space that it was in and and just to see something like that out of the studio, because, you know, his studio has all this other stuff in it. So when it was actually in the museum being displayed, it was kind of pristine and the space that it was in was so perfect for it. And I think that he was very proud. You know, I think he was very proud that it was there.
What happened? You know, so here he is. He's confronting mortality. He's saying that it's action in spite of the knowledge that all is vanity. And what a heroic act that is, the ultimate heroic human act. Now people are reacting to the work, and they're feeding his vanity. Did that have any impact on him? People, because they must have loved it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's sure. I mean, it definitely would have impacted. It's hard for me to say exactly what his reaction to that is. I think people, his work has always been very accessible. So I think people respond to it. He's not somebody an artist who's hard to get.
Yeah.
So I think that he's always gotten a lot of sort of positive reinforcement from people who enjoy his work. And I think, you know, this piece was certainly, I think people felt very upset that he was going to actually do this.
Well, it amazes me that even after that, even after people said how beautiful it was, that he didn't change his mind. They go, yeah, maybe I, just as a favor to them, I'm going to keep it. I mean, Hugo, so then there, again, spoiler alert, we know how this ends. It ends in a heap and a dumpster. How did he look then, and how would you compare his sort of reaction to that to the reaction to the finished piece?
You mean the finished piece in the museum versus the dumpster?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I think that I would say that the day, we call it the dumpster day, when we actually took it to the dumpster was a really emotional day for him. I mean, no question about it. And I do think at the end of it, it's hard to pick this up in the film, but I thought this was a fascinating thing. Even at the end, there's this huge dumpster in back of the museum. He brought this special tape, which he put all around the exterior of the dumpster on the top. And I was up on a lift filming down on the dumpster, but he literally created a frame and then placed it.
Carefully.
Place the piece carefully in the dumpster so that it would be like one last, yeah. You know, he sort of one last amazing collage of this thing. So right up until the end, he's an artist. You know, he can't not do something. He can't do something that's not going to be beautiful or that he's not going to be interested in the way that it looks. So I thought that was a really interesting thing for me to watch.
I've left you about 30 seconds for this one, but what is it? What did it do for you as a filmmaker to think about all these deep thoughts as somebody who makes art in film?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, he was like a coach. He gave me so many amazing things and marriage counseling. No, he and his wife and their relationship, amazing. Yeah. You know, I learned so much, and I really felt so honored to be able to spend time with him.
Great film, Olympia. Thanks so much. Olympia Stone, a documentary filmmaker, the latest called Cardboard Bernini. You can find out more at her website, floatingstone.com. Our website is stateofthings.org, and you can find out more about us. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.